Her first instrument was a Muppet Babies keyboard. Then it was the mandolin. And at age 6, she switched over to the violin. But sometimes it's a fiddle. She plays classical music, folk music, and she wears her Southern Kentucky roots with pride. You hear elements of all those aspects of Tessa Lark on her debut recording, which is called Fantasy. That's what you get to explore this week on New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Almacher. I'm talking with violinist Tessa Lark. She's just put out her very first recording called Fantasy. Welcome, Tessa.
It's a pleasure being here.
So when you meet somebody for the first time, how do you introduce yourself?
I say, I'm Tessa.
Or maybe a better question is, once somebody gets to know you, what will they learn about you that maybe would be surprising?
Okay, so if I'm meeting somebody at an airport, for instance, usually they see the fiddle on my back and they say, oh, what's that? Or is that a violin? I say, yes. I usually say I am a violin soloist, and then I play classical and sometimes some folk music as well. And that's usually the part where they say, oh, that sounds really cool. You know, or the other question is, can you really make a living out of playing music? And of course, it's very possible. But yeah, that's pretty much what I say. I love music and I wear my Southern Kentucky roots with pride.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, because you come from the world of folk, bluegrass, and classical music, and that really happened somewhat organically for you. Can you talk a little bit about your roots?
Yeah. So as I just said, I was born and raised in Kentucky, and my parents, though neither are professional musicians, they both have amazing ears, and my dad does play regularly in a gospel bluegrass band. He sings and plays banjo, so music was around my house all the time, and all different types of music, NPR and MPR and all of those great programs of classical music, as well as the CDs that my parents listened to. My first instrument was actually the mandolin when I was around 4 years old, and I brought it, I remember, to my kindergarten class for show and tell and played Boil 'em Cabbage Down, and then for recess I decided that instead of playing with my friends that I would just face a corner and continue practicing Boil 'em Cabbage Down. So my interest in playing and studying instruments started quite early. And then I had formal classical lessons starting at the age of 6, which got me into classical music. But folk music was always a part of my training and playing.
So I thought your first instrument was a Muppet Babies keyboard.
Well, there is that too, I guess, alongside the mandolin. You might be right. My memory of the age of 3 and 4 might be a little incorrect. But I did, yes, I had a Muppet Babies keyboard, and my parents saw me picking out tunes from the radio, first with my right dominant hand, and then putting my two hands together. And so by the time they saw me playing left and right hands at once at the piano, they thought, well, maybe we should get her some music lessons of some sort.
Well, even though your parents weren't professional musicians, I mean, they really went out on a limb to make sure that you had all the training you could have, and in fact drove a couple of hours on a Saturday morning to get you to some special training.
Yeah, a sacrifice that I didn't really appreciate until my later years in life. I joined the Cincinnati Conservatory of Music's pre-college program called Starling, which still exists to this day, run by Kurt Sussman's house, when I was around 11 years old. And that was when I really started taking violin quite seriously. And that required a 2-hour drive every Saturday to Cincinnati. Spent the whole day there, had amazing opportunities, theory classes, chamber music, coachings, private lessons, chamber orchestra, coachings and performances and solo concerto opportunities, and then would turn around and drive 2 hours back home. And my mom was usually the one taking those trips, but my dad often put in a lot of time too. And I am so unbelievably grateful to them for supporting that, but also just being the open-minded people that they are, and really supporting my passion as a musician. And then my brother, my older brother, is my only other sibling, supporting his passions, which are extremely different from mine, but he's now a very, very successful mechanical engineer. So my parents were really creative and supportive of both of our endeavors.
Well, and it's certainly paid off. You've received numerous awards, including the 2016 Avery Fisher Career Grant. You won the Nauburn competition in 2012, which really launched your career. And one of your more memorable competitions was the Menuhin competition, and you didn't win that one. So what was so memorable about that in 2011 that made such an impact on you?
Yeah, the Menuhin competition, that was actually in 2004. And what happened there is that, I didn't win any prizes. I didn't even get past the first round. It was my first international violin competition. But two judges, I guess, voted for me to go to the next round. And one of those judges was Miriam Fried. And I met her there, and the Menuhin competition offered an opportunity for us to speak with the jury after our performances to glean some insights from them and suggestions. And I remember so vividly that she said she heard my passion in a Prokofiev piece that I played, but she did not like my Mozart at all. And no one had talked to me so directly before. And I wasn't upset. I was just surprised and really curious as well. And so she agreed to meet with me when we both got back to the States, because the Menuhin competition was in London, England that year. And after that point, had lessons with her off and on until college was about to come up. And so I auditioned for her, and she was going to begin full time at New England Conservatory the year I was going to college. And I found my teacher through this competition that I didn't even progress through. So it was an amazing gift that I ended up at that competition when I did.
Now, I know that you also had a bit of a setback due to an injury, some inflammation in your arm or something. Did that happen while you were in college then, or when did that happen?
Yeah, I competed in the Tchaikovsky competition in 2011 and was really psyching myself out in a lot of ways. And luckily now a lot of musical training is paired with some psychological training as well, because playing an instrument is just as much a mental challenge as it is a physical one. And I was not paying attention to that leading up to the Tchaikovsky competition, and was overplaying, overpracticing, overthinking. And I think the combination of just overdoing everything led to, yes, some tendonitis, carpal tunnel symptoms, and I had to stop playing for a few months after the competition, which made me miss the violin a lot and appreciate what it was that I did and was able to do. And as soon as I was able to play again, I was forced to approach it with a more lighthearted attitude. And I am so grateful, as many of us are in a weird way, those of us who've been injured, I'm grateful for what that injury taught me about what is important in music, and how important it is that one approaches it with love and with patience.
That's very good advice. I just wanted to quickly ask you about From the Top. I know that you're going to be the guest host on an upcoming program, and you were on the program, right, as a student performer?
Yeah, as part of the Starling program that I was talking about that I participated in for several years in Cincinnati. I was on that show as part of the Starling Chamber Orchestra, and I played this four-violin concerto by Maurer, think was the composer's name, Symphonia Concertante. That was around 2003 or something. And flash forward, I've had a lot of fun collaborating with From the Top ever since then. But this was my first time hosting a show. And it was super fun because it was in my alma mater. It was at Jordan Hall at New England Conservatory, which is where I went to school with Miriam Fried. I co-hosted with my partner, Michael Thurber. So there are just so many connections that were coming together, and it felt like such a beautiful full circle moment to be able to host the show. And needless to say, the young talent that they always get on that show is so amazing and unbelievably inspiring to see and to hear, and super fun to also interview them and get the inside scoop. That's always been a favorite part of my From the Top experiences, is getting the skinny on these young performers and the fun little skits they do sometimes.
You recently released your debut solo recording. It's a collection of fantasy pieces, and it's called Fantasy. Tell me a little bit about this fantasy world that you've created on this recording.
Well, thanks for saying I created a world. You never know when you're making a CD. You just kind of go with where your passions direct you. I was given a great opportunity to sort of choose a project of my own through the Lenore Annenberg Fellowship Fund for the Arts. I was given one of these grants several years ago, and at first I had proposed to make a recording of the 12 Telemann solo fantasias for violin. But as I was preparing for that recording, I was crafting recital programs to input some of the Telemann fantasias to practice them in front of an audience. And usually it would only include three or four fantasias. They're very, very short, as sort of bookends or palate cleansers to a larger program. And one of those programs included other fantasies by Schubert and Ravel and Kreisler and Schoenberg. And I decided that I really liked that program, and it added more variety of sound and style, and that I wanted to record that program instead. And the Annenberg Foundation agreed that that would be a nice project. And so I recorded it in 2016 with one of my great friends and favorite humans in the world, Amy Yang, a wonderful poetic pianist, and with Judith Sherman, an incredible Grammy-winning engineer and producer whom I met through my summers at Yellow Barn, which is a great summer program. And so I put together these fantasies, Schubert, Ravel, Kreisler, and a few Telemann fantasias. And by the recommendation of my friend Ara Guzalemian, he said, why don't you put a fiddle number in there, since that's so integral to who you are as a person. And I had no idea what was going to fit on the CD of, you know, very straight ahead, very classical music. So the morning of my final recording session, I sort of put together a couple of tunes that I knew from over the years and extracted a little bit of Schubert from his fantasy and created this Appalachian fantasy. Actually, the fantasy track that's on the recording is the very first time I ever played that piece, and it's in one single take. So that's a fun little trivia tidbit.
How did you make the decision to honor Schubert as part of that?
Schubert, something that's unique to him and that draws me to his music so much and so many others is this poignancy and melancholy that's in his sound, especially in his major keys, which is quite ironic, but there's just something so unbelievably intimate and touching and personal in this poignant way in his music. Find that Appalachian music, which is quite different, by the way, from bluegrass music, you know, these qualities I find are also apparent in old time and Appalachian style music. Because a lot of that music is hearkening back to the struggles of the life of coal miners. So there is a lot of pain and agony and sadness in these tunes that were written around that time in the area where I grew up. So I thought it would actually be fitting to take a melody of Schubert's and sort of craft it into a more Appalachian style tune. So it was with a great and utmost respect of both of these styles of Schubert's music and of Appalachian music that I put the two together.
When it comes to the Schubert Fantasy in C major, I know that some say that this is one of the hardest piano parts ever written for this work. Can you talk a little bit about that and the challenging fingering and how you and Amy Yang collaborate on that piece?
Yes. Well, luckily, it doesn't seem so difficult for Amy, but I've always been struck. I called her poetic earlier. And I think this poetic nature of her thinking and going about life and playing is absolutely perfect for music like Schubert. Though I did dabble at Muppet Baby's keyboard, I'm not much of a pianist myself, so I can only imagine what the difficulties are of this piece, but even the opening tremolo, I think, is enough to scare away most pianists from wanting to play the piece. And another challenge about this piece is the reception of it, because if you execute it very well, it doesn't come off as a necessarily extremely virtuosic piece. So it's really a selfless endeavor to practice and work on this piece and be able to execute it properly. But for me, what I've found, and in my collaborations with Amy, what we found is that we usually tend to focus on the more profound aspects of the musical intent as opposed to the technical challenges. If that's ignoring issues that need to be addressed, that's one thing. But for me, at least, I still manage to have to tackle these technical difficulties, but I'm having more fun doing it.
Yeah, well, it is a very emotional work. It's based on a song that he wrote, which translates to mean, "I greet you," And in reading the text, it sounds like a love story.
Yes, it seems that way to me as well. And I guess by nature of the term fantasy, you know, there's this opening material that sounds largely unrelated to the melody, which appears suddenly out of nowhere in the middle of this really grand work. Variation ensues from there. So it's fascinating also to grapple with the challenge of sort of deciding how much one puts the meaning of the song that Schubert stole from himself into this fantasy, or if he was simply recycling material that he liked to create something entirely different. It's sort of the frustration and the beauty of working on music like this, that we don't have the answers, but we try our best to sort of figure out what it was that Schubert was going for. But it does sound very much to me like a love song. And then at the same time, there's this sense of reminiscing, I feel, that's also always apparent in Schubert's music, which is quite amazing because he was never that old, but a very wise sound, and especially when that theme is presented for the first time, is just one of the most miraculous moments in music.
Why did you decide to include Fritz Kreisler's Viennese Rhapsodic Fantasia on this recording?
I just love Kreisler so much. A lot of these pieces that I included, I simply love them. And I got lucky that they all had fantasy or rhapsody in the title. So there was a theme there. But with Kreisler, his pieces are extremely popular, but that one is not as much until, I guess, in recent years, people have discovered it and programmed it and played it a little more. It was, I believe, the last piece that he ever composed, and it's just an amazing tour de force through Viennese sounds and cultures. I always like to say it kind of reeks of Vienna or Wiener Schnitzel or something. It's just very classic Viennese sounds. Almost a tour also through Kreisler's greatest hits. It just has everything that Kreisler has to offer in one little piece, morsel. And it's just so much fun to play. And one of the reasons that I was drawn to sticking with the violin, this very romantic, heart on sleeve and playful music. So I always try and include Kreisler whenever I can.
Ravel's Zagan has this extended solo opening. In fact, we're almost halfway through the piece before the piano joins you. What role is the piano playing in this work?
Well, I suppose, right, he was first imagining the cimbalom. a different instrument altogether, and not actually the piano. So the piano, in a way, is like the Romani band. And the violin is, of course, just this total wild personality that cannot be tamed throughout this 8 or 9 minute saga through a fiery and untamable soul.
Now, I have seen in interviews that you have said you feel like an imposter when it comes to playing bluegrass. Is that still true?
You know, as life goes on, I start to feel more and more like an imposter everywhere I go. And remember, I was saying earlier on that the musical training is just as much psychological as it is physical. It's a thing that I'm working on. But I sometimes do. You know, there's I feel very lucky to be able to collaborate often with artists who are so much more experienced than me and who are truly living legends. And it's hard to feel like I'm the real deal when I'm sitting next to, you know, 12-time Fiddler of the Year winner, however many awards he's won, Michael Cleveland, or when I'm playing a duo with Edgar Meyer. These are just formidable artists, and I have so much to learn from them. So, you know, I'm actually happily feeling like an imposter in a lot of those cases, being able to collaborate with such a caliber of artistry.
And of course, how did they get where they are? Probably the same way you're getting where you're going. So it's a good path to be following.
Well, I hope I'm doing the right thing, yeah.
A new recording called Fantasy with violinist Tessa Lark. Thanks to Valerie Kaler for producing this episode of New Classical Tracks. Before you go, though, let's talk about how these stories get told. New Classical Tracks is a public radio podcast, and it's supported by your donations. This show and shows like it only happen with your support. You can donate today and also spread the word about this podcast and take a moment to rate and review us on your podcasting app. That's New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Almacher.